Okay, good evening, everyone. Try it again. So we're up to now our third part in the Shalom Bayis series. And what I wanted to, originally I actually had a different shiur or a different topic prepared for this evening, but being that we really didn't finish our topic from last week, so we'll continue Miratz Hashem with a little bit from last week into this week. So last week, we opened up the topic of conflict. So again, I put a little cartoon on the top of the sheet. I apologize. The quality didn't come out so well over here. But if you can't read it, as you can tell from the picture, it's a husband and wife conversing vigorously with one another. And the caption on the bottom is, "I can't remember what we're arguing about. Let's keep yelling and maybe it'll come back to us." Right? So this idea ultimately that we spoke about last week, that conflict is part and parcel of any relationship. By definition, whenever you're trying to create a life with someone who's not your mirror image, there is always going to be some element of conflict. We spoke about the idea, the word conflict often carries with it a negative connotation. But in reality, there's nothing negative about conflict. Conflict just means two. There should be extra sheets, by the way, if anyone needs. Maisha, you know what, just do me a favor. Perfect, great. I think back to these things. So conflict really is just the manifestation of two different people, often from two different worlds, trying to build a united life together. We saw last week, we examined the three different areas of conflict. So we'll continue a little bit on that theme tonight. So I wanted to share with you one of the books that I've been quoting from extensively over the course of this series is The Seven Principles for Making Marriage Work, Dr. John Gottman, which is required reading, should be required reading for marriage. Excellent book written in a very user-friendly fashion. And a lot of times, like, you read self-help books or therapy books or marriage books, and the truth is, it's very esoteric, very pie in the sky. This is very, very tachlitic, right? Gives a lot of tachlis advice that is exceptional, that is implementable, that is usable. So here, Dr. Gottman introduces something that I think is really very incredible. If you take a look, let's read number one together. See, he writes, "Every marriage is a union between two individuals who bring to it their own opinions, personality quirks, and values. So it's no wonder that even in very happy marriages, the husband and wife must cope with a profusion of marital issues. Some conflicts are just minor irritants, but others can seem overwhelmingly complex and intense. Too often, couples feel mired in conflict or have distanced themselves from each other as a protective device. Although you may feel your situation is unique, we have found that all marital conflicts, ranging from mundane annoyances to all-out wars, really fall into one of two categories." And I found this to be an incredible piece, that all marital conflicts fit in to one of two categories. Of course, this rule is true, except when? Right, when you're married. When it's not, right? So meaning, again, this obviously, he's taking a general, a panoramic view of marital issues. Of course, all of us know that marital issues never could fit into many more categories and constructs. But ultimately, again, for our purposes this evening, two different categories. Either they can be resolved, or they are perpetual, which means they will be a part of your lives forever, in some form or another. Once you're able to identify and define your various disagreements, you'll be able to customize your coping strategies depending on which of these two types of conflict you're having. So these are the two categories of marital conflict, what we'll call perpetual problems and solvable problems. So just to give you a little bit of an insight into both of these, the solvable ones are much easier, right? The solvable, and again, we'll give some examples. Actually, let's go back for a moment to perpetual ones. Perpetual problems, not even that name or that title, that category, sounds ominous, right? If I would take a show of hands, who here has perpetual problems in their marriage? I would venture to say none of us would want to raise our hands for that, right? Because it sounds really terrible. But at the end of the day, every marriage has perpetual problems. Perpetual problems represent the realities of any relationship. Personality quirks. You might be married to someone who has certain personality. I'm avoiding eye contact with my wife as I say this, right? Right? You might be married to someone who has personality quirks. Those quirks are not going to change. They're not. Sometimes they could be adjusted. Sometimes if they really irritate my significant other, I could work on it. But a lot of times we are who we are, and there are just certain nuances to our personality. Like if someone is a sarcastic individual, The truth is, most probably, they're not going to become the warm, mushy, emotive type. Now, they may need to turn to, to tune down or to diminish their sarcasm. Because sarcasm, forget about marriage, is just a terrible midah. It's just a horrible, it's a corrosive midah that eats away at your neshama. It's not good. Right? So a person might not be able to totally get rid of their sarcasm, but the chances are they're not going to turn into a warm, mushy type of personality. So there are sets of perpetual problem, personality quirks, family realities. No matter what you try, you're not going to change your spouse's family, and you're not going to change your family. Those could be perpetual problems. Different wants and expectations. Sometimes people just come into marriage wanting different things, and people just want different things out of life in general. See, perpetual problems sound like that there's something fundamentally wrong. There's nothing wrong. These are just realities in a marriage. Realities in a marriage, and there's a recognition that they may always exist. Can I be blissfully happy with perpetual problems? Absolutely. Absolutely. As long as you understand them and accept the realities that they create. On the other hand, there's what's called solvable problems. So kishmo kinu, like the name says, solvable problems don't really represent any major underlying issues. Rather, they're more about general marital dynamics. See, he goes on in the second paragraph on the left-hand side still. These couples intuitively understand that problems are inevitably part of a relationship. Much the way, this is an interesting mushel, much the way chronic physical ailments are inevitable as you get older. They are like a trick knee, a bad back, an irritable bowel, a tennis elbow. Not good mashallah for marriage, but you understand what he's trying to say. We may not love these problems, but we are able to cope with them, to avoid situations that worsen them, and to develop strategies and routines that help us deal with them. Psychologist Dan Wiles said it best in his book, After the Honeymoon, when choosing a long-term partner, this is such a great line, when choosing a long-term partner, you will inevitably be choosing a particular set of unsolvable problems that you'll be grappling with for the next 10, 20, or 50 years. Every marriage has these unsolvable problems. These challenges that are just there. They're part of the fabric of my marriage. They're part of the fabric of my life. And it's just a question as to how I'm going to deal with it. Look in the right-hand paragraph. In unstable marriages, perpetual problems like these eventually kill the relationship. Instead of coping with the problem effectively, the couple gets gridlocked over it. We're going to talk about that later. They have the same conversation about it over and over again. They just spin their wheels, resolving nothing. Because they make no headway, they feel increasingly hurt, frustrated, and rejected by each other. The Four Horsemen, we didn't cover this in any of our topics, but in the beginning of his book, he speaks about the Four Horsemen, right? The reference to the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, right? That when these four things appear in your marriage, it's bad news. Those four things are criticism, contempt, defensiveness, stonewalling. So again, we'll save that maybe for a different Shalom Bayis series. But in any event, he goes on. They become all the more entrenched in their positions. Gradually, they feel physiologically overwhelmed. They start a slow process of trying to isolate or enclose this problem area, but actually, they have started becoming emotionally disengaged from each other. They are on the course toward parallel lives and inevitable loneliness, the death knell of any marriage. So let's spend a little bit of time focusing on this idea. Solvable problems versus perpetual problems. So again, we gave a couple of examples of each, but sometimes, I'll show you something very interesting, and Dr. Gottman discusses this extensively. Sometimes it's not so easy to see the difference between them. I'll give you a simple example. He gives actually a very good mushel. See, he gives the example of two couples. Now, much of the examples in his books are really based on couples that he worked with. See, he mentions two couples, which I'm assuming he changes all the names, right? So he talks about two women, Rachel and Eleanor. Both of them have the same problem, which is their husbands drive too fast. And every time they get in the car, it's incredibly anxiety-provoking. But interestingly enough, they both deal with it in different ways. Eleanor tells her husband to slow down. Her husband says, I'm a perfectly safe driver. She gets annoyed. She gets flustered. Please slow down. He says, have I ever had an accident? And she says, no. He says, leave me alone. She says, well, you know what? Drive as fast as you want. You'll kill us both because you don't care about me anyway. And he says to her, that's just like you to say that. Just like you to say that. Because the truth is, you never trust me with anything. That's scenario one. Scenario two, second lady. This is Eleanor, or what? I don't know if I got that right. First one was Rachel, second one was Eleanor. Right? Eleanor says to her husband, you know, you're driving really quickly, and when you drive quickly, it makes me a little bit nervous. To which her husband responds, you know, I'm driving quickly because, you know, we carpool together to work in the morning, and you're always running late. And she says, I'm always running late. That's because you use the bathroom first, right? And you shower forever. I don't even know what you're washing anymore, right? You shower forever, forever. And he says, well, the truth is because when I get bathroom time, the bathroom was like prime real estate in our home, right? And when I finally have the bathroom to myself, yeah, I guess I take a couple of extra moments to go ahead and relax. She said, and you know, it's very annoying when I come down to the kitchen and you're honking the horn, telling me to get out. Well, he said, I wouldn't honk the horn if you were just ready. Well, I have to make breakfast. Well, why can't you prepare it the night before? So amazingly enough, both of these women are complaining about their husband's driving. But notice the difference between the two cases. In the first case, in the first situation, in the first couple, where the wife says to her husband, you know what? Just drive however you want. You'll kill us both. You don't care about me anyway. And he says, you don't trust me. They have a perpetual problem. There is something fundamental going on in their marriage where the wife is saying to the husband, you don't love me. You don't care about me. My safety is not your concern. And the husband is saying to the wife, you don't trust me. There are trust issues. That's a perpetual problem. So perpetual, I want to just point out, doesn't mean that the problem has to exist forever. But perpetual problems really refers to those things that are really in the kishkas of the marriage. There's something fundamentally that's going on in the very fabric of the marriage. Versus in couple number two, that's a very solvable problem, right? What's their problem? Scheduling, right? It's a scheduling problem. Okay, we're getting out of the house too late in the morning. I feel like I have to drive to a Meshuggah to get us to work on time. We have a solvable problem. However, we're going to solve it, but this is a question of logistics. Our marriage is fine. Our feelings for one another are fine, but we have run into a home, a family life logistical issue. So it's the same issue. It's the same complaint by two women against their husbands that they drive too fast. Yet in case number one, it represents a fundamental underlying issue. A wife feeling that her husband doesn't love her or care about her. A husband feeling that his wife doesn't trust him. In case number two, we just set people a little bit on each other's nerves because we're running into some scheduling issues with one another. So sometimes you could tell the difference clearly between perpetual problems and solvable problems. Other times it's a bit more nuanced. So if we accept this premise that all marital issues could fall into one of these two categories, so of course what we want to try to do with a little bit of time that we have together is to try to discuss some basic strategies for dealing with these issues. So how do we deal with perpetual and solvable problems? So let me begin with just two basic strategies. Then we'll delve into strategies unique for each category. The two basic strategies, strategy number one, in general, with dealing with all marital issues, is communicate basic acceptance of your partner's personality. Communicate basic acceptance of your partner's personality. We've spoken about this many times. This goes back to our first class, right? When looking out the window of the other. Things look a certain way from my window, but they may look dramatically different from my partner's window. It's important to every once in a while take the time to look out the other's window. You never know what you're going to see. So it's interesting because all of us do this. Anyone who's privileged to be a parent, we do this with our kids. Right? But sometimes you have difficulty doing this with adults. I'll give you a simple example. Your child comes home very upset because they didn't get to play on the swings at school. So what do you want to say?
It happens.
You'll play tomorrow. Oh, you're such nice people. Right? What I want to say is, really? Really? Like this is what you're bothering me with? Right? It's fine, right? The world's going to go on. You're just fine. You're just fine. Suck it up, move on, and let's go. Right? Right? Come on. We're going to spend 50 minutes processing your feelings year over year because of how you didn't get to go on the swing. But I know that I have to do that. Right, because I know to tell my five-year-old, come on, what are you doing? What's the matter with you? Right, there's nothing wrong over here. Look, you have a roof over your head, you have food, you have clothing, you didn't get to play on the swing. So what? So what? I know that it's not a logic, even though I want to do that, but that's not a logical approach because I have to meet my five-year-old where he or she actually is. We all know that you have to do this with children. We just sometimes fail to do this with our spouses. So when a spouse presents a problem, sometimes as I'm hearing the problem, I'm thinking to myself, be careful when you answer this one, right? I'm thinking to myself, none of the men want to answer this, right? I'm thinking to myself, really? Really? Like, are we actually having this conversation? Are you actually complaining about this? Is this actually a problem? Out of all the things that are going on in life, this is what you're upset about? This is what you're talking to me about? This is what you're complaining about? But again, and because from my perspective, I don't understand what the problem is. But so much of conflict resolution requires me to stop and to communicate a basic acceptance of my partner's personality. Tell me why you feel that way. I don't understand how you're feeling. Tell it to me. Tell it to me. I can't pretend to be in your head. I can't pretend to understand how you see things or why you see things or how you understand things. But the first step in proper conflict resolution is let me understand where you're coming from. Sometimes I can do that on my own. If I just take the time to process and try to see where my spouse is coming from, I can do it on my own. Many times I can't do it on my own, and I have to engage my spouse. I don't understand what you're feeling. I don't understand why you're so upset. I don't understand why this is bothering you so much, but I'd like to understand. And if you're willing to explain it to me, then I could potentially help you overcome your issues a little bit better. Going back to our driving mushel, right? Going back to our driving example, it would be the difference between a wife communicating to her husband. Although, you know, again, this example could go, you could insert husband or wife wherever you want. But let's say it's the wife who feels that her husband is driving too quickly. It's the difference between yelling at him, please slow down before you kill us, versus saying, I know you like driving fast, but it makes me really nervous. You see the distinction between those two statements? Please slow down before you kill us is a condemnation, is an attack. It's implicitly saying or explicitly saying, you don't care, you're reckless, you're going to do whatever you want. Versus saying, I understand you like to drive fast. I don't know why you like to drive fast, but you do. But I want to tell you how your actions make me feel. When doing that, I'm validating where the other is coming from, but at the same time also voicing my concern or my difficulty with your particular approach to action. So that's step number one, communicating basic acceptance of your partner's personality. Step one in conflict resolution. Step two in conflict resolution, and then we're going to get into some more specific ideas, but and this probably is one of the hardest aspects of conflict resolution, is don't aim to be right. Not sometimes, the worst thing you could ever do in the realm of marital conflict is to always try to be right. You know, the Sfas Emes has, the Ger Rebbe has such a beautiful idea. I mentioned this in Shul a couple of months ago. He talks about the major distinction between adults and children. He says, if you notice again, what happens with adults? Adults could get into an argument, right? They get into an argument and a big fight with whoever it is. And what happens? They're still angry 20 years later. 20 years later, they're still angry. What are you angry about? I don't know, but I know it was bad. Right? I know it was bad. I know that I don't forgive you. Why don't you forgive me? I don't know, but I know I can't forgive you. Why can't you? I'm angry. I'm angry. That's just the way that it is. What happens with children? You ever notice a child does something amazing? You see this to children all the time, with their friends, with their parents. Your child throws a tantrum and is angry and is upset and hates you and doesn't want to talk to you and can't believe you mistreat them like this. And then what happens? You buy them an ice cream cone. And what happens? It's like Gan Eden again, right? Everything is fantastic. Everything is fine. Kids get into an argument, and then just a couple of minutes later, they're ready to reconcile. What's that distinction? Why is it that adults hold on to things for so much longer than children? This last sentence says something so beautiful. He says, because children choose being happy over being right. Adults choose being right over being happy. How many Shalom Bayis problems are perpetuated? Because I need you to tell me I'm right. I need to be, is that the goal, right? Is marriage some type of scoreboard to figure out who's been right the greatest number of times? You get the heavyweight belt, right? You know, you get the crown, right? You're the king of the marriage because you are the queen of the marriage because you've been right more often. The goal is not to be right. In fact, it's better to be wrong every single time and be happy. So many times in conflict resolution, I should say so many times, the reason why conflict does not get resolved is because everyone, husband and wife, are focused on being right. I need to be right. But if we stop focusing on being right and we start focusing on being happy, we could find that an incredible number of conflicts could be dramatically resolved. But let's dive in now to specific strategies regarding both of these particular areas. So let's start with our solvable problems. So remember again, our solvable problems. Now again, I don't want to in any way minimize the impact of solvable problems because they are significant as well. But the good news is they're solvable. So going back to our example with the woman whose husband drives too fast and he says that's because you're always running late in the morning. And again, then the whole volley of accusations goes back and forth. You take too much time in the shower, too much time in the kitchen, okay, so on and so forth. So there, all we need to do is identify what is at the core of the issue. So in that driving example, so at the core of the issue ultimately is what? Is a logistics issue, is a scheduling issue. But so many times, the difficulty in getting the conversation off the ground is when a conversation begins with criticism. You know, as I'm going through this series, so it's amazing that Shalom Bayis, at least trying to have good Shalom Bayis, doesn't require anything that all of us don't already know intuitively. Right? There's no like chidushin over here. There's no like grand idea that no one ever heard before. That, oh, had I only known this, then my whole life would have been different. It's basic ideas in interpersonal behavior. If you have a problem with your spouse, you have to begin with what Dr. Gottman calls softening your startup. How do you address conflict? You see, a lot of times when conflict comes up, the way it begins is with a criticism, right? Let's talk about how you do A. Let's talk about the time you did B. What happens when someone criticizes you?
Defensive.
You get defensive. And the moment you get defensive, is the moment that any type of helpful dialogue leaves the room. So sometimes if you want to be able to deal with solvable problems, a person has to avoid criticism. Criticism only makes people defensive. And once there's defensiveness, at the end of the day, there's nothing really constructive. Just to give you the example, if you remember last week when we were going through some of the examples of conflict within biblical marriages. If you remember, again, one of the examples we brought up was Yaakov and Rachel. So Yaakov and Rachel are an incredible example of this. Because what does Rachel say to Yaakov? Rachel says to Yaakov, Havali banim, give me children. V'im ayin meisa anochi. And if you don't give me children, I'm as good as dead. What is she doing? What is Rachel Imenu doing? Not intentionally, but it's out of pain and frustration. What is she doing?
Accusing.
She's attacking. Now, she probably doesn't mean to attack Yaakov Avinu, but she's attacking. What does Yaakov do? Yaakov responds defensively. Right? Yaakov says, hey, I didn't do anything to you. Right? It's not me. It's you. I have children. So whatever is going on over here is between you and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Gemara says, Yaakov, how can you talk to your wife like that? She's telling you that she's in pain. She's telling you that she's suffering with infertility. She's telling you that she wants children more than anything. And you essentially tell her, not my problem, your problem? But again, it's an incredible study. This is what happens when you come off with the attack. This is what happens when you begin the dialogue with a criticism or a critique. people become defensive and no helpful dialogue could come along. So when it comes to solvable problems, although there are many different strategies that Dr. Gottman advances, for our purposes tonight, the solvable problem represents that issue, which could be acute and be significant, but I know it doesn't have anything to do with any underlying issues in our marriage. It has to do a lot of times just with superficial issues or sometimes even logistics. Let's talk about it. But in order for us to talk about it, we have to have that soft startup. Let's not accuse. Let's not criticize. Let's not approach this with complaining or with contempt. Let's just have a conversation. And if we have a conversation, we can unravel this solvable problem and Emir Tzashem solve it. The greater challenge, of course, comes about with perpetual problems. So remember again, perpetual problems represent, and again, I just want to say again, perpetual doesn't have to mean that it's going to be a part of your marriage until 120. What perpetual just means is that it's part of the fabric of the marriage. There is something in the kishkas, right? There's something in the heart of the marriage that is a little bit off kilter that needs to go ahead and be readjusted. So how do you deal with perpetual problems? And again, whether it's personality quirks, whether it's family, whether it's just a general lack of feeling loved or feeling secure or feeling understood. So here I want to quote to you. I didn't put it on the sheet, but I'll just read it to you. So this, I thought, was also another incredible idea. So this is in Dr. Gottman's book, he has seven principles. His sixth principle is what's called overcoming gridlock. This is an incredible chachma. So listen to this paragraph. He says, gridlock, of course, is this state of being when you realize you have a perpetual problem in your marriage, and I don't know what to do. So I'm stuck. I'm stuck right now. I don't know what to do. So listen to what he writes. To navigate your way out of gridlock, you first have to understand its cause. Whether the issue is momentous, like which of your religions to pass on to your children, or ridiculous, like which way you fold dinner napkins, gridlock is a sign that you have dreams for your life that aren't being addressed or respected by each other. Now, by dreams, he doesn't necessarily mean dreams like necessarily in an aspirational sense. But by dreams, I mean the hopes, aspirations, and wishes that are part of your identity and give purpose and meaning to your life. One more piece. Dreams operate on many different levels. Some are very practical, such as wanting to achieve a certain amount of savings, but others are profound. Often, these deeper dreams remain hidden, while more mundane dreams piggyback on top of them and are easier to see. For example, underneath the dream to make lots of money may be a deep need for security. So a lot of times, what he's saying over here is where these perpetual issues come up, is, and his lashon is really quite incredible, that perpetual issues come up when one or both parties in the marriage feel that we have dreams for life that aren't being addressed or respected by the other. So remember, going back to our driving example before, couple number two, the wife feels that her dream to feel valued, loved, but respected by her husband are not materializing, right? The husband feels his dream to be respected by his wife is not materializing. So ultimately, again, that's where we get into these perpetual issues. So how do you overcome this gridlock? So he says something truly amazing. I'm going to share with you two stories that he tells that I think are just, are really, really incredible. So he tells a story. A lot of his book is based on these couples that he had. It was actually interesting. He created this laboratory. He called it the Love Lab, right? And the Love Lab is where he studied couples. These couples agreed to be interviewed. They were monitored on video camera, which is incredible. So like their behaviors, there was two parts to the analysis. There was like the actual meeting and discussions with the therapist, but then they were also observed when the therapist left. Because everyone knows that if you want to see how a couple really is, wait until the therapist leaves the room. Because some people are wonderful at maintaining a good composure while there are other people around. But clear the room, and sometimes that's where the fireworks begin. See, he tells a story of this couple. He calls them Catherine and Jeff. Catherine and Jeff were happily married. And then B'Shal Tova, Catherine became pregnant. And when she became pregnant, they started distancing from one another. Why? What happened? So Catherine grew up in a very religious Catholic family. And Jeff was an agnostic. They just didn't believe in anything. So he felt that as Catherine was pregnant, she was becoming more and more rooted in her religious beliefs. And he actually overheard a conversation between Catherine and her father. Catherine was speaking to her father about baptizing the baby. And with this, Jeff lost it. You want to go with the religion stuff? That's fine. No son of mine is going to be baptized. So they show up to Dr. Gottman. And again, and he describes actually their state, because he describes the fact that it's not just that they were arguing. He was able to see through their physical cues and physical, they were totally disconnected, totally disconnected. So after hurling accusations back and forth a little bit, so Dr. Gum says, okay, we now have a situation where we have gridlock. How do we overcome the gridlock? So the only way to possibly overcome it, now remember again, is this a perpetual issue, a perpetual problem, or a solvable problem? It's a 50-50, right? Right. The truth is, it's hard. It's perpetual. Because at the end, now again, remember, it doesn't mean perpetual problems can't be solved. But this is a perpetual issue because this gets to the fundamental issues or the fundamental identity and character of the two people in the marriage. Catherine is a religious lady. She values religion. She wants to pass that down to her child. Jeff doesn't believe in it at all. So Dr. Gottman gets working with them, and something amazing comes out. He says, Catherine, why is it that religion is so important to you? Why is it? So she says, to be honest, my parents got divorced when I was very young. It was a terrible divorce. My father dropped out of our lives for 10 years. And my church community embraced me. And the pastor and and they became like a surrogate family to me. And they were always around me, and they always took care of me. And I am here today. I'm able to stand on my feet because they took me in when my own family was unable to support me. And that love and that feeling of being propped up and that feeling of community is so special to me that I want to give it to my child as well. Beautiful. Turns to the husband, Jeff. What's your problem with religion? He says, the truth is, I come from a very solid family. And anything and everything I ever needed out of life, I got from my mother and my father. I have excellent parents, excellent extended family. They were always there, always with an open ear, always an open door, always attentive, always here to take care of us for whatever we needed. And I'm concerned that if my child has religion in his life, his relationship with God is going to take away from his relationship with me, his biological father. So you understand now what's happening over here in this marriage. A mother who feels that religion is so important because it gave her strength when nothing else in life did. And a father who feels that religion will diminish the bond that he is going to have with his baby. But the moment that Jeff understood Catherine, and the moment that Catherine understood Jeff, did they solve the problem? No, right? Remember again, the Shiloh, of course, is what are you going to do about baptism, right? So remember, the Shiloh is still there. The issue is still there. The challenge is still there. But suddenly again, the light bulb goes off. You see, up until this point in time, what happened? See, Jeff just thought that Catherine was being selfish, that she was ignoring his needs and putting her religious beliefs above and beyond anything else. He thought that he was being cut out. She didn't understand what exactly his problem is. I'm not asking you to practice anything. I'm just ultimately asking that our child maybe go through just a basic baptism, whatever that entails. I didn't do the research on that, right? But whatever that entails. But suddenly again, the light bulb goes off and each understands where the other is coming from. Is there a meeting of the minds? No. At the end of the day, Jeff still doesn't want a baptism. And Catherine does. But at least they understand where they are both coming from. And just to tell you, interestingly enough, the resolution the resolution in this particular situation was that Jeff would be okay with the baptism, but he wanted to make it clear that he would always remain an agnostic. Don't try to push God on me, right? I'm going to remain an agnostic. But ultimately, again, he did not want, he wanted to agree that their child would not go to a Catholic school. So I'm okay with the baptism. I'm okay with the baptism. But at the end of the day, no to the Catholic school. So this was, again, it still represented a perpetual problem. There was still an ongoing issue, but they were able to overcome the gridlock because each took the time to understand where the other was coming from. A couple of other examples of this. Listen to this case. Perhaps for some of you it may resonate. Listen to this. Quoting from the husband, unnamed husband. I think my wife is too neat and tidy. I find myself constantly trying to find things after she has cleaned up. I think she's being inconsiderate and overly controlling, and I'm tired of it. Okay, that's the husband. The wife, I like a certain amount of order and neatness in our home. I find myself constantly cleaning up my husband's messes. I think he's being inconsiderate, and I'm tired of this. So the good news is, they're both tired, right? Baruch Hashem, right? He's tired of her, she's tired of him. But again, so here's what's incredibly amazing. So you would say, okay, here's a situation of, again, is this perpetual or is it solvable? The truth is, the only way to know is how. What's driving this? What's driving this? So is it that, you know, and again, this, by the way, I chose this example because I can't tell you how many Shalom Bayis problems stem from this. Who's the knee freak and who's a little bit sloppy, you know, changes from home to home. But this tension is a very real one. And what's amazing over here is you'll think to yourself, okay, they just have different habits. People's cleanliness habits are very much reflective in their familial upbringing. And that comes from one of two sources. Some people grow up in a type A home, where everything has a place, and there's no such thing as not putting something in its place. So again, there's a seder, there's an order, there's something to be said for that. Orderliness is an incredible midah. Seder is incredibly important for life. So that's the way I was brought up, that's how I act. Other times it's the opposite. Sometimes people, having grown up in such a chaotic, disjointed home, swear to themselves, I will never be like that. You know, I think I mentioned this. I don't know if it was this class or maybe a different class. You know, there are some people who spend their life looking for their keys. Looking for their keys. And I say that as a metaphor. Like, they never know where anything is. And literally hours, and over the course of a lifetime, days and weeks are spent looking for stuff. And the truth is, that's a terrible way to live. Life requires seder. Life requires an order. And if you don't have order, it's going to impact your kids. It's going to impact you. It's going to impact your marriage. So the question is, if I feel that my wife is just too neat. So we have a gridlock. I'm annoyed because I put something down for 3 minutes. It's not even there for the night. It's just there literally because I have to put it down somewhere, right? I can't hold everything in every second throughout the day. So I have to put it down on the dresser, on the table just for a second, I promise. It's under an hour. But yet I turn around and Baruch Hashem, it's gone, right? It's gone and it's back in its quote unquote correct place. I don't know where that correct place is. I never made that correct place. I never agreed to that correct place. I never signed on to that correct place. It's my stuff and I don't know where it is. So we reach a gridlock moment. And again, the wife saying, such a chutzpah. Why do you leave your stuff all over the place? I have to clean up after you all of the time. And so the shaila is like this. A couple could butt heads about this for an entire marriage. Or could say, what's the underlying issue over here? Wife, why are you such a neat freak? What is it? Is it a reaction to how you grew up? Either mimicking what you saw or wanting to be the opposite of what you saw? And husband, why is that you're a little bit more lax in this? Again, am I going to solve the problem? Probably not, because two different people with two different approaches. But at least at the end of the day, I could understand where the other one is coming from. Again, there are many, many more examples of things like this in terms of like emotional disposition. Sometimes one spouse is very emotional, emotive, and the other is much more stoic, much more intellectual. And so if you're an emotional person and your spouse is not emotive, you feel stonewalled and you could feel unloved, you could feel unappreciated. And the truth is that there might be nothing further from the truth. If people are wired differently or have different dispositions, a lot of times people become a bit more intellectual and less emotional because of hurt or trauma that they've endured in the past. Sometimes people are more intellectual because that's how they themselves were raised. We're different people with different backgrounds, with different upbringings. So a lot of times when it comes to these perpetual problems, the only way to overcome the gridlock is to stop focusing on the manifestation of the problem. Try to peel back the layers and understand what is it exactly that is happening over here. So if we bring this kind of all together, what we have over here is as follows. We have two basic categories of marital issues: solvable problems, perpetual problems. The solvable problems, as the name says, they might be major and they might be significant and they might cause an incredible amount of angst and animosity. But the good news is, it's very often about logistics. It's very often about details. Let's just sit down, not criticize, not attack, no contempt, no criticism. Let's talk it out and let's figure out how to make a plan forward. Perpetual problems represent issues that really get to the core either of our relationship or the core of our individual identities. Very often those are things that we're not going to change. So I might not be able to change it, but I at least want to understand what the dynamic is. Because if I can understand the dynamic, if I can understand where you're coming from, and you can understand where I'm coming from, although we may not be able to solve the problem, we absolutely can manage it. Let me move on to one other piece. Take a look at number 3 on your sheet. So here's an incredible statement from the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish writes, on a little bit of a different topic, now just as we close out this series. The Chazon Ish writes, Kimidos Megunos Arla Slev. Negative character traits are like an arla, right? Like a covering on the heart. So grows Dalte HaChachma Venotlos Sha'arei Bina. So here the Chazon Ish writes about the need for proper midos, the need for proper character traits. That a person can have all of the Torah in the world, a person can have amassed all of the knowledge, but if you don't have midos tovos, if you don't have good character traits, it's like the heart is sealed off. And in number 3, this is from Rabbi Shragi Neuberger's Sefer on Shalom Bayis that I quoted from last week already. See, he says something over here. He says, V'chein hu be'in azivuk. This concept of midos tovos, of good character traits, is something so incredibly necessary in marriage. Emachosan v'akala. Rotzim lachios b'shalom bayis. Tzrichim lavot ala chochma hagidola shel tikun amidos. This is incredible. See, Rabbi Neuberger takes a different approach. Yes, you have to approach the solvable problems, the perpetual problems. You have to have a soft intro, a soft startup. You have to go ahead and overcome gridlock. And you know what else you have to do? You have to be a mensch. You have to have good character traits. You have to have midos tovos. If you don't bring midos tovos, you know, Tachikami gives an example in his book, and I'm sure we've all had situations like this. You ever have a very heated conversation with your spouse, maybe even bordering like on a fight, maybe even bordering on a war, mamish, and then something amazing happens, which is your phone rings, and it's someone from work, right? And you pick it up, and how does the conversation go? Hey, how are you? Right, hey, how are things? Right, oh, good. Oh, good. Oh, I'm so sorry. How are the kids? Right, how's the wife? Oh, you're going on vacation. Fantastic. Where are you going? Great. I'm going to catch up with you tomorrow. You are such an idiot. I can't believe you always do this to me. What is that? And it happens to all of us, right? It's this incredible thing. It's almost like we have like this split personality. To the world, I'm like a charmer, right? To the world, I'm the nicest guy in the world. But to my spouse, sometimes for whatever the reason, the midos, the character traits that we bring to our other life relationships, we do not bring into our marriage. The basic midos, the basic character traits that I bring to every other life relationship, work relationship, professional relationships, friendships, I don't bring into my marriage. I just don't bring it. So when Neuberger writes over here, like the Chazon Ish is saying, without midos, without proper midos, without proper character traits and knowing how to treat your spouse, not just like a human being, but like the center of your universe, there's no shalom bayis. He goes on, skip a little bit, skip the paragraph beis. He says, "V'hinei v'sarim daiku b'lashon ha-mishnah." He says something very beautiful over here. The Mishnah says, "Ezu gibor hakovesh es yitzro." The Mishnah Pirkei Avos says, "Who is strong? One who is able to rein in his yitzer," which literally means his inclination or proclivity. "Madu alo arminan hakovesh es yitzer hara." Why doesn't the Mishnah say, "Who is strong? One who is able to rein in his yitzer hara, his evil inclination"? Instead, it just says yitzer, inclination. Listen to this. Vapirush Bazet, this is incredible. Shelakol echod ve'echod yeshnam devarim miyuchadim shehem hamaakvin oso mila'alos beruchnius v'lios ben aliyo. The Alkin. So what is the Mishnah telling us? Ezu gibor hakovesh es yitzro. Yitzer refers to your greatest challenge with your midos. And all of us have different midos challenges. Some people struggle with anger. Some people struggle with jealousy. Some people struggle with animosity. Some people struggle with all different kinds of things. The greatest manifestation of strength is figure out what your weakness is and address it. Paragraph Gimel. V'chein hu b'nisuin. Shekol echad sarech liros ezehu mida hi'ikuv hagodol bebinyan habayis. Listen to this exercise. Imagine you go home tonight. You take a few minutes by yourself and you ask yourself the following question. What is my greatest weakness that prevents me from being a great spouse? I might be a good spouse, but what is the weakness I have which prevents me from being even a better husband, from being even a better wife? You see, so many times in marriage, we're so focused on what the other is not doing, or how the other is underperforming, or how the other is not giving me what they need. Switch it around for just a moment. Ezu gibor kovesh is, we all have weaknesses. So what is the weakness I have that is preventing my marriage from being as good as it could be? L'ruvein mitzad midas hakas, some people might struggle with anger. Other people might struggle with a lack of order, of orderliness, right? Others, ultimately, again, are stingy and not giving. Others are not kind. Everyone has their weakness. And if you want true shalom bayis, then at the end of the day, I have to identify, what is my weakness? I don't mean what is my weakness in general, because most of us have many weaknesses. But there are usually certain weaknesses which acutely impact my marriage. So what is the weakness, or what are the weaknesses I have that are acutely impacting my marriage? And work on those things. He goes on, he says, paragraph, hey, va'aklahu bazeh shakalalomin mitayosav. So he quotes in the paragraph that I skipped, he's down. So let's see, he'll say to yourself, Sunu, how, I don't know, I can't figure it out. I've searched, right? I've introspected, I've looked up and down, inside out, and I can't find my weaknesses. That's incredible. I just can't find it. So he gives a very good answer. Go back to your last fight. Go back to your last fight with your spouse. Analyze that episode and see what you could have done differently in that episode to make things a little bit better. And generally, where you see what you did wrong, that's your weakness. That's your weakness. I would venture to say, I don't know anyone who can't actually find their weakness if they go in and they do enough introspection. But if you're one of those lucky people, go back to the last flare-up, see where things went so wrong, what you could have done differently, or how you should have done things differently, and ultimately, again, recognize that as the weakness you have to work on. So it turns out that when it comes to shalom bayis, there's all of these different things. There are things that we do to create awareness. There's looking at the wind out the window of the other, appreciating the differences of the other, identifying solvable problems versus perpetual problems. For the solvable problems, ultimately, again, devising strategies to solve them. For the perpetual ones, even if I can't solve it, I need to try to understand where you are coming from. Those are things that we do collaboratively. But there's a strong element of shalom bayis that is a solitary pursuit. And that is me working on me. Me working on me. What do I have to refine in order to go ahead and be a better spouse? What are the midos that I can work on in order to create a better marriage? Because if I am the best version of myself, of course, that doesn't by itself create an incredible marriage, but it's certainly a step forward. And imagine if you have two spouses, each working collaboratively on the solvable and perpetual problems, while simultaneously also examining their own personal shortcomings and faults and working on themselves as they're working collaboratively, suddenly again you're on the road towards a blissful marriage. I'll end off with one last piece. If you look at number four on your sheet, and with this we'll conclude the shiur, we'll conclude the series. One of the Sheva Brachos that we recite is especially beautiful. The bracha that we say is Sameach Tisamach Reim Ahuvim Kisamechacha Yitzircha Began Eden Mikadem Baruch Ata Hashem Sameach Chasan Dekala. So literally translated, it means rejoice, beloved companions, as God made you happy in Gan Eden of old. In Gan Eden of old. So the bracha is comparing a Chasan and Kala to who? To who? Adam and Chava. So the Baal Shem Tov, the Lubavitch Rebbe, both bring this up. And said, it's interesting. Like, essentially what we're saying to the Chassan and Kala is, you should be as happy as Adam and Chava in Gan Eden. I mean, I don't know. I could think of like some better brachas than that. Right? First of all, Adam and Chava not in Gan Eden for all that long. Right? Second of all, I don't know, out of all the marriages we read about in the Torah, I don't know that Adam and Chava are like... You know, I don't know that anybody's putting that figurine on top of their wedding cake. Like, I don't know. Like, it's interesting. You want me to be like Avram and Sarah, like a power couple, to be like Yitzchak and Rivka, Yaakov and Rachel. Okay, I can. But Adam and Chava, first of all, we don't even know so much about them. And the stuff that we do know about them is so tragic. Remember, again, Chava gives to Adam to eat from the Eitz Hadas, such a terrible thing. Right? She gives him to eat without telling him what it is that she's giving him. He blames her for everything. There's such disconnect and such conflict. And this is the bracha. So the Baal Shem Tov says something amazing. He says, no. We're not trying to tell people that they should replicate the marriage of Adam and Chava. But Adam and Chava had something very unique. You see, sometimes after you get married, there's what's called buyer's remorse, right? And you think to yourself, oh, you know what? I don't know, maybe I could have done better, right? Or maybe this. And when there's conflict, sometimes I think, you know what? This is what I signed up for. Like, this is what it's all about. And that's normal. No one likes to admit it. But that's natural. And that's normal. You make the biggest decision in your life. It's only normal sometimes to second guess and to wonder what happened over here. Do you know what was unique about Adam and Chava? Adam and Chava never second guessed their choice. Do you know why? There wasn't much of a single scene, right? There was not much going on. Adam knew that Chava was his Bashert, and Chava knew that Adam was her Bashert. There was no ambiguity that they were made for each other. The bracha that we give for a chasen and kala is not necessarily that you should have a marital dynamic like Adam and Chava. But just like Adam and Chava had no doubt that they were soulmates, made for one another, we tell the chasen and kala, when you get married, know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's been part of the plan of creation from the beginning, that you husband and you wife create a life together. We don't just wind up with the people we marry. It doesn't just happen. It's part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's preordained plan. Just like Adam and Chava were created for each other, every husband and wife were created for each other. That doesn't mean that marriage is without its problems. And that doesn't mean that there aren't challenges. And that doesn't mean that sometimes things don't work out for a variety of different reasons. But at the end of the day, when we encounter challenges, which inevitably we all will, what I would say is before we employ any of the strategies that we've learned throughout our three classes together, the first step, whenever you hit a bump in the marital road, is husband turn to your wife, wife turn to your husband and say, we were made for each other. HaKadosh Baruch Hu made you for me, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu made you for me. And God always knows what he's doing. And if he knows what he's doing, then some way, somehow, we will, Amir Tzah Hashem, figure it all out. So we should be Zocha, each of us, and in the merit of taking out the time for 3 weeks in the Yashar Koach to everyone for dedicating the time and giving up, I'm sure, precious time that came from other things. In an effort to learn about Shalom Bayis, to learn strategies, hopefully to improve our Shalom Bayis, then in merit to Hashem, we should all be Zocha to find the courage to do the real work that it takes to make marriage not just good, but to make marriage great. We should be Zocha merit to Hashem to have marriages filled with simcha, with passion, with excitement, with dreams, with aspirations. And when we hit the bumps in the road, which inevitably we will, we should find the courage to employ these strategies and others. And always remember that if HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought us together, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu will give us the koach to stay together, to love together, to dream together, and to build together. Thank you. There is Myriv in the base medrash for whoever needs. Have you.
Great stuff. My pleasure. I'm still flying high from the Shabbos when I finally was here.
Ah, incredible.
Unbelievable.
Always.